You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
When President Obama met with Chinese President Xi Jinping in March, he talked about defense and economic issues, reflecting questions many have over what challenge China may present, especially to the Americans and European style of capitalism. In their new book, The Fourth Revolution, The Global Race to Reinvent the State, John Micklethwaite and Adrian Wooldridge argue that we should also be concerned about the challenges the West's way of government may face. John Micklethwaite is editor-in-chief at The Economist. Adrian Wooldridge is The Economist management editor. And their book is published by Penguin Press. I'm very pleased they have come by to talk with us here.
Thank you.
What is or what will be the fourth revolution?
Well, the easiest way to think about it is that we argue that there have been three big revolutions in Western government before. And the starting point was the sort of 16th century. And back then, Europe seemed like a kind of blood-drenched backwater. And all the best government was actually, as you said in your intro, was actually in China. It was the Chinese who invented Mandarin civil servants. It was a time when the biggest, the center of the imperial city had 300,000 inhabitants, and only three European cities had more than 300,000. Anyway, but that was the first revolution, and the Europeans began to form sort of nation states, which were both small enough to never really rival China, never to get so inward-looking, but also strong enough to be able to police their area. And then the next revolution was the liberal revolution of the 19th century, which we think is incredibly relevant today, because that was a time when people, in the name of liberty, dramatically decreased the size of the state, even as they increased the number of services they had. And the example we look at is Britain, where the superpower of the day reduced government expenditure from £80 million to £60 million between 1815 and 1846, but did it whilst providing a police force, adding schools, adding hospitals, and they did it by ripping out all the cronyism, which would be very relevant to Washington today. And the last big revolution was the welfare state, which more or less is what we've all got. This is the 50th anniversary of Lyndon Johnson's Great Society.
So you are not thinking in terms of the American, the French Revolution, or the Industrial Revolution for that matter.
What we're arguing is that the West has been the center of thinking about the state since the 16th century. The West has really pulled ahead of the rest of the world. And when we're talking about the liberal revolution, we mean, of course, partly the French Revolution and partly the American Revolution. But we mean a much bigger process whereby society becomes much more accountable to its members.
Growing out of the Enlightenment.
Absolutely. Yeah. And there are attempts to put limits on the power of the state.
And technology as well. I mean, this is the time of the Industrial Revolution.
Well, one of the people you write about, her name is not all that recognizable to many people, is Beatrice Webb. Now, they may recognize her husband's name, Sidney Webb, but why is she so important to this story?
Well, Beatrice Webb was the founder, in many ways, the intellectual founder of the welfare state. She grew up as a classical laissez-faire liberal who believed all government intervention was a terrible idea. And then as she got older, she began to think, wait a minute, it's a bit unfair that people who are born rich have better opportunities than people who are born poor. And she gradually began to come around to the view that the state ought to intervene to provide decent education, decent welfare, decent health insurance for the ordinary people. And then eventually she became really the architect of the modern welfare state. She founded the London School of Economics. She founded the New Statesman, which was a sort of sister magazine of the New Republic, and became a sort of planner, architect, intellectual godmother of the modern welfare state.
Well, it strikes me as odd that Thomas Piketty's book is having such an impact today. It sounds like he's saying the same thing, and it's sounding revolutionary once again.
Absolutely. What she said is that if society is too equal, the state has a role to step in to try and moderate those inequalities and to try and make sure poorer people have equal opportunities or better opportunities than they would if they were just left to the market. So it was a very, very similar sort of sentiment in the early 20th century to the one we see today.
You quote Alexander Hamilton, who wrote that Americans must decide, quote, whether societies of men are really capable or not of establishing good government from reflection and choice, or whether they are forever destined to depend on their political constitutions on accident and force. Is it that extreme a split, reflection and choice or accident and force?
Possibly a little extreme, but I think that in general there is a very big thing. If you look at the debates about the government at the moment, you have Republicans on one side and Democrats on the other hurling abuse at each other. There is very, and it's all very micro. It's all about whether this thing should be, go forward or that. Nobody has actually stood back and said, what is the state for? And you look at these other big revolutions in Western government. You look at Thomas Hobbes years ago. You look at John Stuart Mill. You look at Thomas Paine. You look at a variety of people who really ask these big questions. And that doesn't really exist at the moment.
Well, didn't the British give us that, the two-party system, or in the case of Britain, the two-and-a-half-party system?
We're responsible for a lot of terrible things.
You discuss a half-revolution. What was that, and why half?
The half-revolution started off in the 1960s and 1970s, then gathered steam and came to fruition really in the 1980s. And that was basically the idea that the state had got too big, too dysfunctional. And the idea was to reduce the size of the state, get the state out of the business of running businesses, and free up the market, reduce the power of the trade unions. This was the revolution of Margaret Thatcher in Britain and Ronald Reagan in the United States.
And do you think that if they had fully realized their proposals that British and American citizens would now be more satisfied with their governments?
Well, I think that they did something very important, which was to get the state out of the business of running industries, which it really wasn't very good at. But what did happen, I think, is that they sort of ran out of steam, that after big efforts, the state begins to increase its size very dramatically and continues to grow. But also you sort of had a strange sort of disjuncture that on the one hand people kept talking about how that, as Bill Clinton said, the age of big government is over, when in fact if you look at public spending it was still very, very high. They created a sort of an illusion.
But you said that government ran things poorly. On a visit to England some years back, when I asked about how poorly the railroads were running, they said, well, they've been privatized. They used to be the pride of England when the government ran them, and now that they've been privatized, you never know when the trains are going to arrive. You never know whether they're going to be in good shape. Has privatization always been the better solution?
I think there's a lot of wishful remembering in that. Is British Rail, which we, I think all three of us in this room remember, was a monstrosity and often didn't ever arrive anywhere near on time. Privatization was certainly bungled a bit on the railways, but actually there's a debate going on now in Britain because some people in the Labour Party have begun to bring it up again, but pretty much the leadership has squashed it because nobody really wants to go back. You might want to do it slightly differently.
Well, Ronald Reagan said government is the problem, not the solution. Are you arguing something similar?
No, absolutely not. We're not arguing that at all. What we're arguing is that
government got bigger under Reagan, didn't it, despite what he said?
Absolutely. Well, there's obviously the division of powers and congressional spending and things like that. But what we're arguing is that government really matters. You'd have to be insane to want to live in a country without any government at all. Government matters. It's not just that we're arguing for a smaller government. We're arguing for smarter government, which might mean smaller government, but it certainly means a government that's competent to do its function. And one of our big worries is that if government is too big, it tries to do too many things, it becomes dysfunctional and it fails to do the most important things that it's supposed to do at all. So it everybody loses.
Can I pick up on that? There is a you look at the left in virtually every country in the world is facing this dilemma. You have government has got very big, very sprawling, and it can no longer do what people on the left want it to do. There is a basic choice for most parties to decide whether they want to really serve the poor or whether they want to keep serving public sector workers.
My guests are John Micklethwaite and Adrian Wooldridge. Their book, The Fourth Revolution, The Global Race to Reinvent the State, published by Penguin Press. Well, the public, the voters, have some thoughts along those lines. Switzerland just recently voted to not raise the minimum wage to, what was it, the equivalent of $25 an hour. But some of the most successful states these days still are the Scandinavian countries. Mm-hmm. They still have big government. Or they still have a huge safety net. So Are they anomalies?
One of the most important stories that we tell in this book is what's happened to the Scandinavian world. Because in the Scandinavian world, government became ever bigger and ever more intrusive from 1945 right the way till the early 1990s. Government just kept getting bigger. And what happened then was a crisis of competitiveness and a crisis of funding. So you had a big problem with the government. And what they did, particularly in Sweden, was to say, actually, there comes a point where you can't go on getting any bigger.
But the Norwegians did something smart. They found oil.
But so the size of government in Sweden has gone from 67% of GDP now down to 49%, which is not that different, really, from the United States. So it's contracted a lot. What they did was not just shrink government, and I can't emphasize this enough, it's not just small government that we're arguing for. They improved the quality of government by balancing their budget, bringing their entitlements in line, privatizing schools effectively by issuing everybody with school vouchers and allowing private companies to run schools, a massive reform program in Sweden.
Well, if the structure of government is facing a revolution, do you think there's a risk to democracy itself?
I do. To this extent is that you have the main alternative, as you started with, which is China, is a much more autocratic system. And behind what we worry about deeply, and we wrote this book partly because we do wander around the world looking repeatedly at different versions of this. And what we worry about when you look at the West is it's like a version, a bit of Sears Roebuck. The worst form of contest to be in is one where you don't know you're in the contest. So Sears spent the whole time battling Montgomery Ward, but didn't actually notice the first Walmart and then Amazon were creeping up on outside it. If you look at Washington is so introspective, so involved in itself that it does not realize that there are other versions out there. And democracy, this is an argument about how to make the state better, but it's also about huge things like liberty and whether our version of liberty and democracy will triumph.
Well, if the United States government is such a mess, why has it been able to borrow for so long at such low rates?
Because it's a big country. It's the lender of last resort. The trouble is that if you get addicted to doing that, there comes a point when suddenly the markets lose confidence. You can't do
America
that.
Cannot continue to govern as if it's a big government country and to tax as if it's a small government one.
You mentioned political divisions in the United States. Are Britain and other countries in Europe seeing the same kinds of divisions? Aren't we seeing a resurgence of the extreme right in countries like France and Greece and, to a lesser degree, Germany?
Absolutely. I think we are seeing, and we're about to see in the European elections, a huge resurgence of right-wing, Tea Party, slightly crackpot parties of all sorts, of the right and the left. But I think what America has got itself into is a position of a sort of stalemate, a sort of very intense battle between the Republicans and the Democrats, which can't really be resolved because they're basically both as strong as each other, and an incapacity to deal with some fundamental problems, particularly problems of entitlements, which most Britain has actually been dealing with these problems. The Scandinavian countries have been dealing with these problems. America is too paralyzed at the
moment. There is one very big similarity, is that there is a basic version of sort of apathy on both sides. Voters are really angry, and yet they expect nothing to change. That is the big thing, that the one statement of one European politician is, we all know what to do, but we don't know how to get elected once we've done it.
My guests are John Micklethwaite, editor-in-chief of The Economist, and Adrian Wooldridge, The Economist's management editor and the writer of the Schumpeter column. They have co-authored a book called The Fourth Revolution, The Global Race to Reinvent the State. It is published by the Penguin Press, and we will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. My guests are John Micklethwaite and Adrian Wooldridge, both from The Economist and the co-authors of a book called The Fourth Revolution, The Global Race to Reinvent the State. It is published by the Penguin Press. In your introduction, you describe a Chinese leadership college. What are they teaching there?
Well, I went to go and visit it. It's fascinating. You arrive, and it has barbed wire on the outside, and you think
it's a good lesson in leadership.
Yeah, you think it's a sort of military thing of some sort. But then you go in, and it feels like Harvard, as redesigned by Dr. No. And it has a huge, great big red building in the middle, like a desk, and it has an inkwell. And now these are all huge buildings, and then dormitories all the way around it, and people scurry backwards and forwards. But the reason why it feels a bit like that is partly because it is trying to learn things from all the way across the country, but it is also all across the world. It is also an organisation set on revenge. The Chinese know, in a way the Americans don't know, what it is like to be on the wrong side of the competition in government. You know, they were the best at this thing, and then the West got better, and the West pulled ahead, and they have not forgotten that.
Well, where are the Chinese turning for examples of good governance? Well, obviously not to the West.
That's the interesting bit. They do not. They came to look at Silicon Valley. They came to look at Wall Street. They came to look at a lot of American industries when they were trying to learn about business. They do not go to Washington to learn about government. They do look at some states. They'll come and look at what the New York's done on policing. They're going to look at some healthcare things. But on the whole, they go to Scandinavia, which Adrian's mentioned. They particularly go to Singapore, which, for understandable reasons, and actually we would argue that a lot of Americans should go and visit it too. Here is a place with a much smaller state than America, but with far better services.
Well, let's talk about Singapore. You describe Lu Kuan Yew, Singapore's first prime minister, as George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, and James Madison rolled into one. That's pretty good for a guy who has been compared to Machiavelli by others.
Well, we slightly say that is his position within this sort of this new tradition. I think it would be rather too much praise to say that, but that he, for that model, has performed all of those roles. And I think there is a very good and a very bad side of Lee Kuan Yew. The good side is that he's created an extremely lean and efficient state system. The bad side, of course, is that he's really crushed human rights, including the right to chew chewing gum, which we all cherish. So it's a very mixed thing. And we're certainly not arguing we would like to imitate Singapore in all its peculiarities. But what we are arguing is that we really in the West need to get our act together. We need to realize that we're up against some competitors who are doing some clever things.
Well, I don't chew gum, but I would fight to the death for your right to chew gum. But as you point out, Singapore has been described as a country where human rights have come to be seen as non-essential in the race towards national economic excellence. So this is a trade-off. Why do we have to have that kind of trade-off?
Well, the answer is we don't think you do. But one reason why the Chinese look towards Singapore and rather like it is the authoritarian angle. They definitely see an advantage. Anyone should look at Singapore and say, here's a way to deliver a lot of services and very cheaply. But the fascinating thing about Singapore is most of the things it does has nothing to do with that. It's nothing to do with being authoritarian, getting good civil servants and paying them huge amounts. The Republican Party could learn a lot by looking at Singapore. Singapore takes government really seriously. It pays people the top $2 million a year because it gets good people to do it. If you keep on saying government is evil, you'll never do that.
But isn't authoritarian government often more efficient? Mussolini was credited with making the trains run on time. Hitler brought Germany out of a deep economic crisis, but there was a price to be paid.
Well, I think Tocqueville once said of democracy that democracy looks very inefficient, very sort of tortuous on the surface, but deep down it has huge strengths, whereas authoritarian governments look on the surface to be very, very strong, and deep down they're not. They're brittle. They can fall apart. And I think that's true. Democracy is the system that we cherish, but in cherishing it, we must be willing to criticize it in order to reform it.
And Churchill also said something about all the flaws of democracy, and yet it's the best system.
Absolutely.
But the truth about American democracy and British democracy, this is not a sort of American bashing book, is that it's got very tatty. You know, you look at redistricting, that is the equivalent of rotten boroughs back in the 17th century. You look at the way that money has got into politics. You look at the way that small procedures can make an enormous difference. There is nothing very democratic about any of that.
But looking at Singapore, we're talking about a city-state with a homogeneous population of 5 million people. It's a lot easier to run a place like that than a city like New York with its diverse population of 8 million. So what example can Singapore really provide for a place like New York?
Well, it's quite interesting that we look to ancient Athens and we take a lot of example from that. Indeed, it invented democracy. So I think just because a country is small doesn't mean you can't learn from it. And I think it is a sort of laboratory of new forms of government, which is how the Chinese treat it. But of course, it's really China that is the the measure here. It's because China is an economy which is as big as the United States now, and China embodies a set of values and assumptions about how the world ought to be organized, which are very different from ours. Now, what we argue in this book is that since the 16th century, the West has been the center of civilization, the center of how government operates. It's had the world to itself. And what's happening now for the first time is that another country, another civilization, is challenging the West. And it's challenging the West not just for preeminence in terms of power, but for preeminence in terms of values. We have the big question confronting us: what sort of values are going to prevail in the 21st century? Will they be the values of liberty and democracy, which are the values which have been at the center of the Western state experiment, or will they be the values of top-down authoritarian modernization? I very much hope they're the first of these, but in order to ensure that, we need to toughen up a bit.
Well, if change in Singapore, China is so dependent on one or just a few people, or if the first prime minister of Singapore then installs his son as his successor.
You have to be very careful where you go on this if you broadcast in Singapore, because they are very litigious. But the one thing which
it's still better than North Korea, where we've had four members of the same family.
They do have the advantage of Singapore. They always point out they do have democracy. But it tends to be democracy, one party wins. And the Chinese one can be very rude about, but they have done one thing. They've done one very good thing, is that at the top, they have managed to have this cycle of every 10 years replacing the leadership. And that has introduced some life into it. This book is extremely rude about parts of the Chinese state, which, as you point out, are a lot less efficient than much smaller, more homogenous Singapore. But it is still, whether we like it or not, there is an alternative out there. And even more interestingly, when they're looking on how to improve their society, or try to improve their government at places like CELAP, they do not come here. They go to Scandinavia, they go to Chile, they go to Brazil, they go to the whole variety of different places.
But there's also a lot of corruption in China still.
Enormous. If you want a statistic, in the US Congress, the combined wealth of the top 50 people in Congress is now $1.6 billion. That caused terrible uproar here. The combined wealth of the 50 richest people in China's National People Congress is $96 billion. It is off the scale, and that does not include any of the dirty money associated with families of the leaders.
My guests are John Micklethwaite and Adrian Wooldridge. Their book, The Fourth Revolution, The Global Race to Reinvent the State, it's published by Penguin Press. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Do you think that people anywhere in the Americas or Europe would accept a government like Singapore's?
No. I definitely don't. And I don't think that they need to, really, because one of the messages...
Well, it relies on cultural factors, doesn't it?
Absolutely. One of the messages in this book is really an optimistic message, is that we have a real capacity to reinvent the state, make it slimmer, but also much better because of modern technology. All sorts of technology is being invented and disseminated, which can make the state much more our servant and much less our master. I mean, you know, the new IT technology, which allows lecturers to lecture not just to 10 people, but to tens of thousands of people across the internet, the sort of technology which allows us to monitor patients in hospitals, out of hospitals, outpatients, with sensors attached to them. There's a huge thing. So we're being pushed towards reinventing the state, partly by necessity, partly by the fact that we spend too much money, partly by the fact that demography is moving the population is aging, essentially. But really, more important than that, we have huge opportunities to change the state, just as we did in the 19th century.
Well, are you saying a line that we've heard a lot in the United States over the years, that we need to look at business for better techniques of governance?
Yes, I think we are, because and I think the miracle is this, is when you talk to people, you talk to the voters who are going to trudge off in the midterm elections, they're going to go off with two assumptions. One is that government is terrible, and two is that it's not going to get any better. And actually, you stand back and you say, is that really credible? If you look at history, government has always been through these revolutions. As Adrian says, if you look at technology, is it really credible that the same sort of technologies have ripped through and completely changed the private sector over the past 50 years will not happen to government? You look at government, some of it is in the agricultural timetable. You have schools which go off for the entire summer so that people can go and work on the harvest. That doesn't make sense in Brooklyn. that you have a lover group of it, which is basically...
Brooklyn actually is growing more of its own vegetables recently, but that's a whole other issue.
It's a farmer's market. But the second bit is a lot which is stuck in the age of Henry Ford. Too much of the state still belongs to the same thing where it tries to do everything. It's like Ford used to own the sheep, also in the fields on which grazed the sheep, whose wool went into the seat covers of his cars. He tried to do everything. That age is gone. And then a lot of government is still in the 70s. When I came to America in probably the early 80s, I arrived, and if you tried to hire a car, you hired a Japanese car, it worked, an American car, it didn't. And cars were very different. Now every car is the same because it's been competed away. By contrast, the state, you can look at bits of the state which are so wildly different, even though they're serving the same people, doing the same things. Why does America put up with having schools which are much worse than Finland's? Why does California put up with having schools much worse than Finland's and pay far, far more for it? Why do you have worse public health care than Sweden and pay far, far more for it?
You list what you call the West's seven deadly sins: outdated policies, inefficient and unproductive. They were unproductive. Interest groups, overactive state, fuzzy math, misdirected aid, paralysis, and gridlock. And you cite California as a perfect example, but hasn't California improved since a kind of a big spending liberal succeeded a lean and mean Arnold Schwarzenegger as governor?
California is a really interesting story because California was in a terrible state. I lived in California in the late 1990s, and things were really grinding to a halt in terms of government. You really looked at government and thought, my God, how can they make things worse? And then they always managed to do it. And I think the really interesting story about California is that they have actually managed to turn things around. They balance their budget. They're dealing with their initiative process. They have this long-term committee looking to the long-term future. And again, I think this underlines a very optimistic message. Winston Churchill once said of America that it always does the wrong thing before doing the right thing. And you can almost say that about democracy, but democracy can turn itself around. California is beginning to turn itself around. We've talked about the example of Sweden, where it really hit the buffers, and then suddenly it really reinvented the state and turned itself around. We saw what happened in New York with Giuliani, when it looked as though the criminals were were in charge of the place, and then suddenly you had a policing revolution which really brought law and order back to the streets.
And then he fired his police commissioner.
Well, that was yes. You get good things and bad things with Giuliani. He did do that, but the police commissioner went off and he moved to Los Angeles, and I think repeated that sort of.
And now he's
revolution.
Back again. Political scientists Martin Gillens and Benjamin Page have a forthcoming paper arguing that economic elites and business groups have far more influence in the United States government policies than average citizens or mass-based groups. If they're right, would that undermine old fears of a tyranny of the majority?
I think that this is the great problem to do with American government, is far too much of it is cronyist. It strikes us when we talk about cutting spending, what we're saying is there is $1.3 trillion worth of loopholes and exemptions in the tax code. And the vast majority of that goes to the well-off, who are not who the welfare state was designed for. Why does America have a system where more money goes for mortgage interest relief for people in the top 5% than goes in social housing for the bottom 50%? Nobody, Milton Friedman, nobody on the right would ever think that made sense. But the politicians, particularly in this case in the Republican Party, are so wedded to interest groups. Why do we end up with the agricultural subsidies? This is not a sensible use of public money. It should be directed towards the welfare of the poor instead.
And it doesn't work that way in Britain with a conservative government?
To repeat, these problems, as we point out, these are across the West. In some of them, America has worse. Others, other places have worse.
Cass Sunstein and others advocate what they call libertarian paternalism, nudging people based on behavioral science. Do you have something like that in mind?
I think that would obviously warm the hearts of Mr. Lee Kuan Yew, who probably have fairly tough nudges.
But I understand Cass Sunstein chews gum.
He's toast, isn't he?
I do think a certain sort of nudging absolutely works. So the simplest example is whether you opt in or opt out to saving money for your long-term future. I mean, many people, if they're asked to opt in, wouldn't do it. But if they're asked to opt out, the money will accumulate and they'll save something for their future. People can be nudged in the right direction.
You, in this book, you focus a lot on individuals, Thomas Hobbes, John Stuart Mill, Beatrice Webb, Milton Friedman, Lee Kuan Yew. Are individuals the drivers of social and political revolutions?
I think it's a mixture. It tends to be really to do with ideas and technology. Technology makes a dramatic amount of difference. If you look back at that revolution, which we think is most relevant to today, the liberal revolution of the 19th century, that was partly to do with big ideas, with people like John Stuart Mill saying, look, we really want to people focus on the liberty of the individual, making the state work.
Wait, more also, than the Industrial Revolution?
No, it was,
the
also
development
to,
of capitalism?
It was also a lot to do with technology. Suddenly you went from a system, thanks to railroads, you could have a civil servant living 100 miles away who could, it felt fine to entrust an area. So as a nobleman, if you were in London, you let someone run Lancashire because it was too far away. Suddenly you have a railway, you can put civil servants, you can get hold of them in 3 hours. That is a very different way to run things. You have new commercial classes coming up. And we are in the middle of a similar time, so we don't see why it shouldn't happen again.
One reason why we focus on those individuals is the question at the heart of this book is, what is the state for? And each one of these individuals had a very striking and comprehensive answer to this question, what is the state for? And we argue in the book that at the moment we have all sorts of potentials to reinvent the state because of this unbelievable information revolution that's going on. But if we are to reinvent it successfully, we need to ask ourselves, what is it for?
Adrian Wooldridge is the Economist Management Editor, writes the Schumpeter column. John Micklethwaite is the Editor-in-Chief of The Economist, and they have collaborated on a book called The Fourth Revolution, The Global Race to Reinvent the State. It is published by Penguin Books. Thank you both so much for being on our show.
Thank you very much.